A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been on a run of safety episodes lately. Hi-Viz, PBE, the history of protective gear, and he noticed something. All these topics live under one header if you're actually buying them, industrial safety. And he wants to know how that header got built. Not just the products, but the structure. How did industrial safety emerge as an industry, coalesce from a bunch of separate hazard responses, and then subdivide into road safety, healthcare, aviation, all these distinct application areas that have their own standards and their own supply chains? Who dominates the field now? And how far have we come since people first started formally recognizing that work can kill you?
And that last part is the thing. Formally recognizing wasn't overnight. It took disasters, lawsuits, and insurance companies doing math.
The answer isn't a single invention or a single law. It's a cascade. Disasters created liability. Liability created regulation. Regulation created markets. And those markets subdivided by application, because a nurse and a road worker don't face the same hazards and don't answer to the same regulators. So today we're building that skeleton. From the first factory inspections to the billion-dollar conglomerates that own your hard hat, and the uncomfortable truth about who actually certifies them.
Let's start with what we're actually talking about. Because industrial safety isn't just a rack of hard hats.
It's the entire system. Standards, testing, certification, distribution, compliance. Everything that sits between a hazard and a worker. And the reason it became an industry rather than just a pile of equipment is that the hazards didn't change, but the legal and economic consequences of ignoring them did.
Right. A factory floor in 1890 had the same spinning machinery as a factory floor in 1920, but by 1920, if someone lost an arm in it, the owner was looking at a lawsuit and an insurance premium hike. That delta is the entire origin story. Insurance companies were as powerful a driver as worker advocacy, maybe more powerful in some periods. They wanted fewer claims, so they started demanding safety equipment as a condition of coverage.
Which isn't the heroic narrative anyone reaches for first.
No, it's not. The heroic narrative is workers organizing and demanding protection, which absolutely happened and mattered. But the thing that turned safety from a moral argument into a line item was the insurance industry realizing that a factory with fire escapes and machine guards cost them less money. That's when the market started forming. Before that, you had individual products. Someone sold gloves, someone sold goggles, but there was no category called industrial safety. It was just supplies.
So the industry didn't emerge as one thing. It coalesced from separate responses to separate disasters, and only later consolidated into something you could name.
And the subdivision by application, road safety versus healthcare versus aviation, that happened because each domain developed its own regulatory bodies and its own failure modes. Road safety got the manual on uniform traffic control devices, and eventually, ANSI 1-7. Healthcare got OSHA's bloodborne pathogen standard in 1991. Aviation got FAA. Part 121 and 135. These are completely different worlds. The person designing a high-vis vest for a flagger on a highway isn't thinking about the person designing a surgical gown.
And yet they're both under industrial safety.
They are. And the conglomerates that dominate the field today play in all of them, but through entirely separate product lines, separate testing protocols, separate sales channels. That's the subdivision Daniel's asking about.
So let's trace the arc. Emergence, coalescence, subdivision. And to understand how we got here, we have to go back to a fire that killed 146 people in a single building.
The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire, 1911, March 25th, Greenwich Village, New York. The factory occupied the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of the Ash Building, mostly young immigrant women, mostly Jewish and Italian. When the fire broke out, they discovered the exit doors were locked. The owners had locked them to prevent theft and unauthorized breaks. The fire escape collapsed. The ladders on the fire trucks only reached the 6th floor.
47 of them jumped.
Yeah. The youngest was 14. It took 18 minutes. And the public reaction was, well, it was what you'd expect. But the key thing is, what happened next? The New York State Legislature created a factory investigating commission, which was groundbreaking. Over 4 years, they inspected almost 3,000 workplaces, interviewed more than 200,000 workers, and produced something like 36 new labor laws covering fire safety, ventilation, machine guarding, sanitation. That commission became the model for workplace safety regulation in the United States.
And the same year, the American Society of Safety Professionals was founded, 1911, directly in response.
Right. So you've got the first organized safety profession emerging literally the same year as the disaster that catalyzed it. But here's what most people miss. The industry didn't spring from that one event. It was a slow accretion. Liability law was evolving through the courts. Unions were gaining leverage. And insurance companies, as we said, were doing the math. By the 1920s and 30s, you had companies like MSA Safety, founded in 1914, originally focused on mining safety, building actual businesses around protective equipment. But it was still niche. It was still, here's a thing for miners, and here's a thing for factory workers, not an industry.
The single biggest forcing function was 1970.
OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, signed by Nixon, which surprises people who assume workplace safety is a left-right issue. It wasn't at the time. The act created the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and gave it the power to set and enforce workplace safety standards. And this is the moment the market was made. Before OSHA, safety equipment was a recommendation. After OSHA, it was a legal requirement. If you ran a factory and OSHA said your workers needed respiratory protection, you bought respiratory protection or you paid fines. That created a floor under the entire industry.
And companies that had been selling industrial supplies, gloves, goggles, boots, suddenly had a regulatory mandate beneath their product lines.
This is when the industry began to look like an industry. Distributors like Grainger, founded in 1927, but they exploded post-OSHA. Manufacturers like 3M, which had been making sandpaper and adhesive tape for decades, looked at this new regulatory landscape and saw a market. 3M entered respiratory protection in the 1970s, and they didn't start from scratch. They leveraged their existing expertise in filtration and non-woven materials. They'd been making filters for other applications. They understood how particles move through media. It was a pivot, not a cold start.
And that's the pattern. Companies with adjacent expertise saw the regulatory floor and stepped onto it.
Right. Honeywell, which most people think of as thermostats, built its safety division through acquisition. MSA was already in mining and fire. DuPont had Tyvek, which came out of their materials science work. These weren't startups sensing a new market. They were established industrial companies adding a safety leg to their existing stool.
So by the 1980s, you've got a recognizable industry. But it's still fairly undifferentiated. A respirator is a respirator. A hard hat is a hard hat. The subdivision comes later.
The subdivision comes from regulation, fragmenting by domain. Different work environments develop different hazard profiles and different regulatory frameworks, and the industry fractured along those lines. Healthcare is the clearest example. In 1991, OSHA issued the Bloodborne Pathogen Standard, that's 29 CFR 1910.W2. It was a direct response to the HIV and hepatitis B epidemics. Suddenly, hospitals and clinics had a legally enforceable set of requirements around gloves, gowns, face shields, sharps disposal, everything. And those requirements were specific to healthcare. A construction hard hat standard didn't help you. You needed products designed for, tested for, and certified for bloodborne pathogen protection.
And that created an entire submarket.
It did. NIOSH got involved with respirator approvals for healthcare settings, N95s, surgical N95s, the whole hierarchy. Companies like Ansell, which had been making industrial gloves, suddenly had a healthcare division. The same basic material, nitrile. But different testing, different certification, different sales channels, different pricing. And that pattern repeats for every application domain.
Road safety got its own moment with ANSI 107.
First published in 1999. Before that, high visibility clothing existed, but there was no unified standard. Different states, different agencies, different requirements. ANSI 107 created a formal classification system. Class 1, Class 2, Class 3, based on the amount of reflective material and the background fabric color. It specified exactly how many square inches of retroreflective tape where it had to be placed, what the minimum luminance factors were. And once that standard existed, it created a market for compliant products. You couldn't sell a Hi-Vis vest anymore. You had to sell an ANSI 1-7 Class 2 vest or whatever the application required.
And the standard itself drove product development. Companies started engineering garments specifically to meet the standard, rather than making something reflective and hoping it was good enough.
The standard becomes the product specification, and that's true across every subdivision. Aviation safety is entirely different. FAA, Part 121 and 135 govern commercial air carrier operations, and they specify everything from fire resistance of cabin materials to crew oxygen requirements to evacuation slide performance. The companies that supply those products. It's a completely separate ecosystem from road safety or healthcare. Different testing labs, different certification bodies, different distribution.
So the subdivision is really about regulatory fragmentation. Each domain got its own rulebook, and the industry split to serve each rulebook.
That's the mechanism. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. Every major industrial safety product category maps to a specific regulatory standard, and that standard was usually written in response to a specific disaster or public health crisis in that domain. Bloodborne pathogens in healthcare, road worker fatalities in highway construction, cabin fires in aviation. The industry doesn't subdivide because it's efficient. It subdivides because regulation forces it to.
So that historical arc got us to a certain point. Emergence from disasters, coalescence around OSHA, subdivision by regulatory domain. But the industry today looks very different. Let's talk about who actually runs it.
The industrial safety market today is dominated by a handful of conglomerates that grew through acquisition. 3M is the 800-pound gorilla. They entered safety through their existing expertise in adhesives and filtration, and now they own everything from respirators, N95s, half masks, full face to fall protection, hearing protection, eye protection, you name it. Their safety and industrial segment is a multi-billion dollar business.
And they're not just making the products, they're writing the standards, or at least sitting on the committees that write them.
That's the part people don't see. 3M employees serve on ANSI committees, NFPA committees, NFPA committees, ISO working groups. The company that sells you the respirator helped write the standard that respirator meets. Is that a conflict of interest? It's complicated. The argument for it's that the people who know the most about respirator technology should help write the standards. The argument against it is, well, obvious.
Honeywell is the other giant.
Honeywell Safety Products competes directly with 3M across most categories. They built their safety division through a series of acquisitions. They bought Elvex in 2016. They bought Scott Safety in 2017 for an undisclosed sum. Scott Safety was a major player in fire service respirators and gas detection. That acquisition gave Honeywell a dominant position in firefighter safety equipment specifically. So now you've got two conglomerates, 3M and Honeywell, controlling a huge share of the respirator market, the fall protection market, the gas detection market.
And then there's MSA Safety.
Founded in 1914, originally focused on mining, they made the first Edison electric cap lamp for miners. They're still dominant in firefighter and mining safety equipment. They've got a smaller footprint than 3M or Honeywell overall, but in their specific niches, they're the incumbent. Fire departments don't switch suppliers lightly, and MSA has been supplying them for over a century.
Ansel for gloves, DuPont for Tyvek and Kevlar.
Ansel is the glove giant. They make something like 40 billion gloves a year across industrial, medical, and consumer. DuPont's Tyvek suits are the standard for chemical and particulate protection. Kevlar, which DuPont invented, is in cut-resistant gloves, ballistic vests, industrial sleeves. These companies don't just sell products, they own the material science that makes the products possible.
But the actual purchase often goes through a different layer entirely, the distribution layer.
This is the part that gets overlooked. Most workers don't buy their safety equipment from 3M. They buy it from Grainger or McMaster Carr or Fastenal. These are the industrial supply distributors, and they exert enormous influence on what products actually reach workers. Grainger reported something on the order of $15 billion in revenue in 2025. That's not a niche business. That's a Fortune 500 company whose entire model is, we stock everything a factory might need and we can get it to you tomorrow.
and their inventory decisions effectively determine what's available.
A 3M respirator might be specified by a safety engineer, but it's Grainger's warehouse that decides whether that specific model is in stock, at what price, with what lead time. If Grainger decides to stock a cheaper alternative from a Chinese manufacturer, that alternative suddenly becomes the de facto standard for thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. The distribution layer is a gatekeeper, and it's largely invisible to anyone who doesn't work in procurement.
The structure is: conglomerates manufacture, standards bodies certify, distributors distribute, and somewhere in there, a safety manager at a factory tries to figure out what her workers actually need.
That safety manager is increasingly not just buying products, she's buying compliance programs, training, data analytics. The industry has evolved from don't die to don't get injured to don't develop a chronic condition. Early safety was about preventing immediate death, fall protection, fire suppression. Mid-century added acute injury prevention, machine guards, eye protection. The modern era adds chronic exposure management, respiratory protection for silica dust, hearing conservation programs, ergonomic interventions.
The time scale of the hazard changed.
Right. A fall kills you in seconds, silica dust kills you in 20 years. The industry had to build products and standards and monitoring systems for hazards that don't show up on the day of the incident report. That's a much harder problem, and it's where a lot of the growth is now. Companies sell air monitoring systems that track particulate levels in real time and feed data to a compliance dashboard. That's not a hard hat, that's safety as a service.
The oligopoly question looms over all of this. When three companies control the majority of respirator production, 3M, Honeywell, and a handful of Chinese manufacturers, what happens to innovation, pricing, and availability during a crisis?
We saw the answer in 2020. The N95 shortage wasn't a manufacturing capacity problem in the abstract. 3M had the capacity. It was a supply chain problem, a demand spike problem, and a regulatory problem all at once. But the oligopoly structure made it worse. When there are only a few suppliers and they're all running lean inventories because that's what modern supply chain management demands, a surge in demand breaks everything. Hospitals were reusing N95s for days. The strategic national stockpile had expired masks. It was a stress test that the industry failed.
The response was to throw money at domestic production, which helped, but didn't change the underlying structure.
It didn't. 3M and Honeywell are still the dominant players. The Chinese manufacturers, companies like McCreight and BYD, gained market share during the pandemic, but they're still primarily OEM suppliers rather than brand-name competitors in the U.S. Market. The consolidation question is real, and it's not just about respirators. Fall protection, gas detection, fire-resistant clothing, in each category, two or three companies control most of the market.
Which brings us to the certification question. Because the whole system rests on the idea that when a product says ANSI approved or UL listed, someone independent verified that it works.
That's the part that's not quite true.
Hubert. Hubert!
I worked 6 months at a place called SafeTech Industries in Gary, Indiana, 1994. My job was dropping hard hats onto concrete.
From what height?
4 feet. The standard said you drop it from 4 feet onto a flat concrete block. You measure the crack. If it doesn't crack on 2 drops, it passes. I watched a guy in a lab coat sign off on a hat that cracked on the 3rd drop. He said the standard only requires 2.
The hat that failed on the 3rd drop got certified.
It got the stamp. The stamp doesn't mean someone independent tested it. It means the manufacturer tested it, wrote down the results, and paid for the paperwork. ANSI doesn't have a testing lab. UL does have labs, but for a lot of industrial safety products, the certification is self-certification. You do the testing, you keep the records, you put the mark on the product. If someone asks, you show them the paperwork.
The ANSI-approved label means the manufacturer followed a standard that an ANSI committee wrote, a committee the manufacturer probably sat on, and the manufacturer tested its own product to that standard and declared it compliant.
That's the system.
The incentive to find a crack on the 3rd drop is what, exactly?
There isn't one. You're paid to pass hats, not to fail them. SafeTech went under in 97, not because of the hats. The owner's brother-in-law embezzled the receivables, but the hats are probably still out there. Some warehouse in Ohio has a pallet of them.
This is the part that makes me, I want to be careful here, because the industry has made genuine progress. Workplace fatality rates have dropped dramatically since OSHA was created. In 1970, there were something like 14,000 workplace fatalities a year in the U.S. Now it's around 5,000, with a much larger workforce. That's real. People aren't dying at work at the rate they used to.
But some of that progress might be regulatory theater.
Some of it might be. If the certification system is self-policing, and the standards are written by the same people who sell the products, and the testing is done by the manufacturer who has every incentive to pass, what are we actually measuring?
You're measuring paperwork compliance. Whether the product works is a separate question, and nobody's asking it unless there's a lawsuit.
How often did the hats actually fail?
Most of them passed. The standard was easy to meet. The question isn't whether most hats pass. The question is, when are the ones that don't still get shipped?
The answer is sometimes yes.
Sometimes yes.
If the certification system is that fragile, what does that mean for the future of an industry that sells protection?
It means the next crisis is already baked in. The 2020 N95 shortage exposed the fragility of just-in-time supply chains. But the certification fragility is a different kind of vulnerability. It's not about whether the product is available, it's about whether the product works when it arrives. And we don't really know the answer to that until someone gets hurt.
As work changes, remote work, gig work, AI-monitored work, the subdivision of industrial safety may need to subdivide again. What does a safety standard look like for a solo delivery driver who's technically an independent contractor? What does OSHA jurisdiction even mean for someone working from a home office?
That's the frontier. The industry's next coalescence probably won't be around physical products. It'll be around data and monitoring. Companies are already selling wearable sensors that track ergonomic risk, air quality monitors that feed to cloud dashboards, AI camera systems that detect when a worker isn't wearing a hard hat. The safety industry is becoming a surveillance industry, and the same conglomerates that sell you the hard hat want to sell you the software that watches you wear it.
The certification question applies there too. Who certifies the AI that decides whether a worker is safe?
Nobody. At least not yet. The standards haven't caught up to the technology, which means we're in another emergence phase. The technology is out ahead of the regulation, and the disasters that will eventually force the regulation haven't happened yet.
That's a grim way to end, but it's also honest. The industrial safety industry was built on disasters, and it'll probably take more disasters to fix what's broken in it now.
The open question Daniel's prompt leaves us with is whether the self-certification model is adequate for the next generation of hazards. If the system worked because liability law and insurance companies created a backstop, even if the certification was loose, the threat of being sued kept manufacturers roughly honest. What happens when the hazards are chronic and the causation is diffuse? Silica dust doesn't leave a paper trail the way a factory fire does.
We've got episodes on high-vis, PPE history, and industrial supply chains if you want to dig deeper into any of the pieces we touched today. But this one was the skeleton, the structure that holds all of it together. And like a lot of skeletons, it's got some cracks.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping us honest, as always.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed it, tell someone who buys safety equipment for a living. They'll have opinions. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.